This brought us into the last section of our study, section 4, the church in the later Middle Ages. I didn't mention that. I just went right into the Crusades. The church in the later Middle Ages, 1122 to 1500. And this is a very important section because in this we do the introductory work for the next our study next quarter, the history of Protestantism, or Western Civ 3. So those of you who be taking that course, which would be most of you, this will just lead right into it. In fact, it's designed that way. So we're looking at the church in the later Middle Ages. We're going to see, by the way, we're going to see it reach its, the papacy reach its high points in some way and low points in other ways. We're going to see what the things that happened to the historic church, which contributed to the Renaissance and the Reformation. Let me repeat what I said at the close of the hour concerning the Third Crusade, 1189 to 1192, on page 142 of our syllabus. I repeat this now because it didn't get on the tape. You recall that the Third Crusade, which was a call to recapture Jerusalem, which had been lost again in the Muslim resurgence, was the three kings involved, Frederick Barbarossa of Germany, Philip Augustus of France, and Richard the Lionhearted. Frederick drowned in the creek, and the Germans went home. Philip and Richard fell to quarreling, and Philip got mad and went home. This left Richard. He managed to land at Acre, but he could not even move on Jerusalem, so he decided to go back home. And here he was captured by the Germans, held for ransom, and his brother John ruled in his place. And, of course, this was the context for the myth of Robin Hood, that Robin Hood was working for Richard to raise the money to get him back home, and John didn't want him back home. Anyway, that's the historical context for the Robin Hood myth. But I mentioned that at the end of the hour. But come to the Fourth Crusade, and I'm going to move very quickly through this one, and the 1202. It was backed by Pope Innocent III, and we're going to meet him in our next discussion. The armies came from northern France. They didn't get very far either. They came to Venice with a view to getting passage to Egypt. And so the Venetians, by the way, we're going to see it. This is one of the main, Venice in northern Italy, right here. Venice was a city-state. It was independent. One of these independent northern Italian states where the Renaissance began. And they were, they had no loyalties except to themselves and to money. And so they contracted. They said, well, look, we'd like to take you by sea down to Jerusalem. But I'll tell you what, you need some money. Where are you going to get money? So they said, take us to Constantinople and we'll get the money there. And they did. So they didn't, as a result, the Fourth Crusade did not ever get to Jerusalem. It attacked the Christian city, the Orthodox Christian city, of Constantinople and took it and divided the city with the Venetians, and they made so much money they didn't even go. And in fact, for a long time, Constantinople was a Latin city, until finally, as I mentioned in the syllabus, in 1261, the forces of the Byzantine Empire managed to retake it. How's that for a crusade? The other crusades and the fate of the Latin kingdoms I mentioned just briefly here, we see the resurgence of the Muslim faith. The crusades diminished in force and result, and it's the first one, the first full crusade was really the only really successful one. In 1291, Acre, the last foothold in Palestine, was lost. And finally, as this Muslim resurgence continued, in 1356, the Ottoman Turks surged into Asia Minor, and in 1453, Constantinople, as we mentioned before, was lost to them. In 1517, the Ottoman Turks crossed the Bosphorus, and they threatened Europe. One of the reasons, by the way, now we're just they cross over, they move up into here, and threaten. They take parts of Hungary and Poland, and what's called ancient Armenia. But I'll simply say this, looking ahead, that one of the reasons, And we're going to come back to this next quarter. One of the reasons why the Protestant Reformation in Germany got a foothold, one of the reasons that it was not wiped out by the Catholic princes, that is, the Catholic military forces, was that the Catholic military forces were busy fighting the Muslims. They had to take time out of fighting the Protestants and go keep the Muslims out of Europe, and it allowed the Lutheran movement time to grow. Now, I just mentioned that as sort of a tag-in to this Muslim resurgence at the end of this period. And this leads us then, this leads us into the next period. Well, the Children's Crusade, they were in this last, they just dwindled off. There was a lot of fanaticism, and the Children's Crusade was just a mob of children who were led to, kind of like the original mobs of Peter the Hermit and Walter the Penniless. They got as far as northern Italy. The Venetians simply loaded them on their ships and took them to Egypt and sold them as slaves. Well, it was the old idea that God would make a way and God would confound the wise with the foolish, and it's just one of those. Crusades is a whole subject in and of itself. And yes, the Children's Crusade was a very, very tragic page in that story. We can't devote any more time to the Crusades. I recommend that you do some reading further on it if you want to, if you're interested in it. I do list here under 9 points. The results of the Crusades. Let's look at these very briefly. First of all, the fall of Constantinople was delayed by the defeat of the Seljuk Turks. That was a result. One of the reasons that Constantinople did stand so long was the Crusades held off the Muslim forces. The Seljuk Turks had been for a long time threatening Constantinople. Secondly, the Crusades hastened the consolidation of various European states, helped to bring about the end of feudalism and the rise of nations, cooperative effort. Third, trade followed the cross. Commerce expanded spectacularly. We talked about the economic reasons for the Crusade. The Crusaders who came back, and many did come back, told about what they had seen in the way of material things. And it was the case of with trade and with the intellectual revolution I mentioned next, people came back and told about the higher cultures they had seen, what people did. It was a case of how you're going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris. The medieval society was never as closed again. It was never as dark again. People knew that there was a world out there. And that this world, you see, that the East, even with the Muslims, the East was vastly more enlightened and wealthy and culture than the West. And just opened the door to trade, opened the door to ideas, and it helped lay the ground for the Renaissance, as I mentioned. However, the moral tone of Europe was lowered even further. There was centralization of power, but war always lowers morality. That's just a rule. It's just a law. It always happens. And the fighting, remember they had first set up, they saw the beginning of persecution of the Jews in Europe? But there was just a great, Europe became even worse, morally. The religious division between the East and the West was intensified. Well, no wonder. First they come in and take Jerusalem and then refuse to give it back to Constantinople. And then on one crusade even takes Constantinople itself. And so any hope of ever unifying the East and the West, Eastern and Western churches was gone after the Crusades. The bitterness between Christians and Muslims was intensified. For a long time, we pointed out that the Muslims and the Christians were pretty friendly toward each other. But not anymore. By the way, much of the modern hatred that the Muslims have for Christianity, although they still permit it, sanction it in their lands, by and large, most of them do, not all of them. It reflects the spirit from the Crusades, not before. Hatred of the Jews was intensified. We're going to see that you hear the first man in Europe was, I think I may have mentioned it, the Crusade sort of unleashed and directed an attitude of anti-Semitism. Who was it who first said we ought to take all the Jews either kill them or deport them or put them in concentration camps and control them and eventually wipe the land free from them? Who first said that?
Adolf Hitler, right? Martin Luther, founder of the Lutheran Church. He advocated that. You know that? The Lutherans are very embarrassed by that. They'd rather we didn't know that. But what Hitler proposed, he was simply taking up the call that Martin Luther had issued. Well, but this general attitude, as you would guess from what we study, was intensified by the Crusades. And last of all, number nine, the superstitions and unquestioning faith in European Christendom was turned to doubt. That is, when you have hatred and murder and deceit and slaughter and tragedy and all in the name of of Christ, all done for the cross. Many of the common people in Europe who already had a very superstitious, low, ignorant view of Christianity now had a very skeptical view of Christianity. By the way, one of the reasons, and we're going to see this continue with the Protestant wars, Catholic and Protestant wars, one of the reasons why Europe, America, by the way, Americans don't understand Europeans. One of the reasons why Europe is a cynical continent, England being an exception, a little bit of an exception. But for instance, look at NATO now. Why could something like Hitler's Germany happen in Europe? The NATO nations, for instance, you have countries like those in NATO, European members of NATO, who are perfectly willing to use the United States, but who are utterly cynical about. In other words, the Western German economy prospers. Why? Because Americans, they have no significant defense budget. They don't need it. Why? We're paying for it. And they're perfectly willing to do that. And as soon as, and they'll let America support them, defend them against the combat. Americans who know what's going on know that if a threat ever came, that West Germany would do exactly what Poland did and what Russia did. They would change to whatever side they have to change to protect themselves. Utterly cynical. Utterly cynical. Why does biblical Christianity have such a hard time in Europe? You see, those who believe in the modern theories of church growth, if you go only to responsive fields, that's why they're going to Africa and South America, Mexico, not going to Europe. Why? You see, there is in European culture a deeply ingrained, bitter, negative, of course, cynicism toward Christianity and toward the values of Christianity. And where did this come from? This is even among those who are officially members of the state church, whether it's Roman Catholic or Lutheran or whatever. Because it goes back to the time of the Crusades, and it gets worse as we go. You see that? So much of that which is obviously anti-Christian was done in the name of the cross that it just developed a general skeptical, cynical, we begin to see now why biblical Christianity, the real thing we would call it, has never been taken seriously in Europe. And we're going to see why even the Lutheran and Protestant movements were minority movements as far as genuine piety was concerned. Well, we'll come back to that, but the deep cynicism is ingrained at this time. We come now to discussion number 28, the church and the state. And this is the dominant theme in a course like this. I refer you back to our earlier discussion of the period of struggle for power between the Holy Roman Empire and the papacy. Well, the Hohenstaufen dynasty was the Holy Roman Empire dynasty that was in power at this time. We look first at Pope Alexander III and his struggle with Frederick Barbarossa. This is before he was killed, of the Holy Roman Empire. Now, I pick out some of these things even as examples of the struggle between the church and the state. They were old enemies, and Frederick simply refused to recognize Alexander as the Pope. And he set up a rival Pope. Frederick was he was a German, and he didn't want this Italian running his country. And so he simply said, you're not the Pope, and he picked another Pope. And as a result, Alexander III excommunicated him, and for 18 years they fought. Frederick marched into Italy to do the Pope in. The Pope had his own army. He's a feudal lord, you know, and so they fought, and the Pope won. He won because Frederick's forces, Frederick came in the summertime, so when you had to fight, and it came south. It's like when the Green Bay Packers played Miami. they sweat a lot when they get out of the those northern temperatures. And it was hot, and they weren't used to fighting, and they got this fever and disease, and they were in a weakened state, and so Frederick lost. However, and Alexander managed to create opposition to Frederick in his own country. A simple thing, if you follow Frederick, you're going to hell. And so Frederick was forced to make peace. And in a famous scene in St. Mark's Square in Vienna, July 1177, he surrendered, much like Canossa again. And therefore, Frederick was vanquished, and Alexander became the most powerful pope up to this time. Underline those words, up to this time. But Alexander III also struggled with Henry II of England. You see where we're going now? I'm just giving examples of the... I'm talking about the important phases of the struggle between the church and the state. Pope Alexander and his struggle with Henry II of England. He was a powerful king. That a feudal system is breaking down. You begin to have nations beginning to emerge. You begin to have kings who want control over their kingdoms. They want to run them. They don't want them to run from Rome. So in order to try to control these ecclesiastical lands, we've seen this again, haven't we? We recall how Otto tried to do this. You cannot control your kingdom if you cannot control the land, and the church owns so much of the land. So he established what came to be called the Clarendon Code. You can read for yourself why it's called that. It called for the control of bishops by the king. It subjected the clergy to civil courts. You can see how that would be important. It limited appeals to papal courts. That is, you could not unlimited appeal to if a priest or a bishop were found guilty of a crime. It restricted the power of excommunication. The Pope just couldn't automatically declare anybody anathema or excommunicate if he didn't like them. Well, interestingly enough, Thomas a Becket, who was a longtime friend of Henry, was an old buddy, an old fishing buddy of Henry II. The highest ecclesiastical office in England was the Archbishop of Canterbury. Later on, we're going to see in the Protestant Reformation with Henry VIII, this becomes, in effect, the papal office of England. But anyway, in this program to throw off as many of the shackles of Rome of Alexander III, the Pope, as he could, Henry put his old friend Thomas a Becket in, installed him in the office of Archbishop of Canterbury, have his own man in office. And lo and behold, what did Thomas do? As soon as he was a loyal churchman, he was a man of the cloth. As soon as he got in office, he immediately switched his loyalties and sided with the Pope in this struggle. His attitude was, I love you deeply, Henry. I appreciate what you're trying to do, but it's kind of like Ambrose. You know, once he became, they installed him as bishop, and he said, well, if I'm going to have the job, I'm going to do the job. And so his attitude was, since I'm archbishop and I've taken vows, I'm going to be faithful to these vows. And so to Henry's deep chagrin, his old friend just switched sides on the day he took office. He said, I represent Rome now. And so the king had him assassinated. But this was a mistake. It caused such a furor in England that the king would do that. Everybody knew what he had done. That he had to back off and withdraw the withdraw the terms of the Clarendon Code, and Nicholas won. Henry had to pull in his horn. And by the way, what famous play is based upon the murder of Thomas a Becket? Murder in the Cathedral. Right? It's been a movie made of it. And I've seen them. It's the drama that is caused when Thomas changes his loyalties when he becomes Archbishop of Canterbury. Well, we come now to Pope Innocent III. You need to know this guy. Innocent III, and by the way, look, if you want the years, I give them in this little summary. Look ahead in your syllabus to page 148, your parenthetical study. Six popes to be remembered. Okay? And we haven't got to Boniface VIII yet, but we will. But Innocent III, 1198 to 1216. You must know Innocent III. Innocent III claimed that God had given to him not only the government of the church, but of the whole world. By that he meant Europe. He wasn't doing much with the Muslims. But Innocent III, as I say on page 145, was the most powerful of all the popes. He came the nearest of any to actually wielding the power and authority outlined and claimed by Gregory VII. Remember Gregory VII and his concept of the medieval papacy? Well, he never pulled that off. No pope ever pulled that off. Listen to me. The Roman Catholic Church will tell you, if you ask them, that no pope has ever actually realized the power that belongs to the papacy. The claims of the papacy have always been greater than the actual influence, power, and authority of the papacy. And, the Roman Catholic Church still claims what Innocent III claimed and what Gregory VII claimed. So what we're saying, I'm not teaching you that Innocent III enjoyed all the power and authority and preeminence claimed by Gregory VII in his ideal of the medieval papacy. What I'm saying is that Innocent III came the closest of any pope in all the history of the church to actually wielding that authority. He came the closest of anybody to pulling it off. And he was, in his lifetime, the most powerful man in Western Europe, in the Western world. Okay? Innocent III, I discuss here, and the Holy Roman Empire. When the electors, the Holy Roman Empire was made up of certain princes who were called electors, and they would choose the king. When the electors were unable to choose a successor to Henry VI, they couldn't agree, the Pope stepped in and said he would choose between the two successors, and so then he set about to let them bribe him. When Otto made the best pledges, he crowned him king of the Holy Roman Empire, but later when Otto didn't keep his promises, he deposed him and put Frederick II after extracting certain promises. So my point here is he was able to put his man on the throne of the Holy Roman Empire, which was something. When Innocent III struggled with King John of England, there was a debate over who was to be Archbishop of Canterbury, this highest Roman Catholic office, and John refused to accept the Pope's appointed man, and so the Pope excommunicated him. Well, this didn't bother John, he just ignored it, and the Pope took the next step, Innocent III took the next step, and put the country under papal interdict. That is, the sacraments could not be offered, no forgiveness of sins. When John still refused to yield, he offered the crown of the King of England to the King of France. And so the King of France got to hear that, because he didn't want France and England were always at war anyway, and were going to be for several centuries, and he wanted a pretext, an excuse, a pseudo legal reason for invading England, and now he had it. I'm going to invade England. Why? Well, because the Pope, the Holy Father, has given me the crown of England and told me to go get it. Go take it. Well, now what did John face? He faced not simply a fretting and fuming and anathemas and interdicts and excommunication bulls from Rome. Now he faced the French army and navy, which was more powerful than he. France was the most powerful of other European countries at this time. And so only then did John have to give in. See how the Pope did it? Innocent III simply said to the King of France, I give you the crown of England, go get it. So John gave in, and the Pope called off the King of France. And John's concession is a famous one. I put it in the syllabus. Let's read it together. Here's John giving in. John, by the grace of God, King of England,
Lord of Ireland, Duke of Normandy and Aquitaine, Earl of Anjou, to all the faithful in Christ who shall inspect this present charter, greeting. We will it be known by all of you, by this our charter, confirmed by our seal, that we, having offended God and our mother, the Holy Church, in many things, and being on that account known to need the divine mercy, and unable to make any worthy offering for the performance of due satisfaction, see that? Satisfaction to God and the Church, unless we humble ourselves in our realms, we, willing to humble ourselves for him who humbled himself for us even to death, by the inspiration of the Holy Spirit's grace, under no compulsion of force or fear. That's a big lie. the French Navy looking down his throat. But still, under no compulsion of force or fear, but of our good and free will, by the unanimous advice of our barons, offer and freely grant to God and his holy apostles, Peter and Paul, and the Holy Roman Church, our mother, to our Lord the Pope, Innocent, and his Catholic successors, the whole realm of England, and the whole realm of Ireland, with all of our rights and appurtenances, for the remission of our sins, and those of all of our race, as well quick as dead, that is, going to get the people who died in the meantime without the sacraments, get them off the hook. This charter was to get them out of purgatory. Y'all see that? Why it had to include them? And from now receiving back and holding these as a feudal dependent from God and the Roman Church, in the presence of the prudent man Pandulf, who was the papal legate, subdeacon, and one of the household of the Lord the Pope, do and swear fealty for them to the aforesaid our Lord the Pope Innocent, his Catholic successors in the Roman Church, according to the form written below. We do liege homage to the same Lord the Pope in his presence, and if we shall be able to be present before him. That is, we're bowing long distance. If we see him, if I go in present, I'll bow in presence. Binding our successors and heirs by our wife forever, but in like manner to the Supreme Pontiff for the time being, and to the Roman Church, they should pay fealty and acknowledge homage without contradiction. We're going to come down to Henry VIII. When the Pope tries to pull the same thing on Henry VIII, it doesn't work. But it did work this time. Okay, so Innocent won that battle. You got that? He managed to put his man on the throne of the Holy Roman Empire. Okay, he managed to make John of England knuckle under. Well, how about France? Now, France always was the most powerful European power at this time, as I've said. And remember I said before that the French Catholic Church was always kind of a state church. It never really bowed to Rome. But Innocent III came the closest to anybody to making it bow. But he forced Philip II to take back a wife he had divorced. And that showed his power. When the Dukes of Southern France refused to eradicate the Cathari, which was a heretical group, it was really a Reformation group, Innocent III declared a crusade against Southern France. Remember I told you before that in all the Dark Ages, what area was the most cultured, the most enlightened? Southern France. Remember the Paulicians and the minor groups that objected to the extreme doctrinal vagaries of Roman Catholicism, where were they? Southern France. And so in Southern France, the Cathari represent, really, a Reformation. And the Pope wasn't going to have that. And we're going to meet the Cathari again when we study the history of Protestantism. So he declared a crusade against Southern France. He simply told the Northern princes, the dukes, the aristocrats, you have my permission to go down and take their land, and they did this. A terrible war was fought, and the economy of Southern France was destroyed for a long time. It just about ruined Southern France. Innocent III held and dominated the Fourth Lateran Council, which was the most important council in the Middle Ages. After the death of Innocent III, Frederick II, the Holy Roman Empire opposed his successor, and the struggle continued, and the power of the papacy began to decline. In all this, as one historian put it, quote, the papacy bartered spiritual leadership for temporal rule. One of the things that the Roman Church gave up when Innocent III so openly, blatantly asserted his power over nations, used what you could call nothing less than political power, was that to the extent that the nations of Europe were forced to acknowledge, forced to bow to the papacy as a political power, to that extent did the papacy diminish as a spiritual force. And this was going to help prepare the way for the Reformation, yes.
When Brother Francis, Brother Francis, was that called by Inquisition?
No. Inquisition is a different thing. The Inquisition begins in Spain, not France.
Later on.
Well, we come to the church in, well, what happened after Innocent III died? Remember that the leading power, that he actually was more powerful than France, the Holy Roman Empire, and England. Didn't have any trouble with Spain. Spain was just was in his back pocket all along. What happened when he died? Well, then the church, the number one, as you can guess, France was not forgetting how that Innocent III had humiliated Philip. And so when Innocent III was gone, France became the leading European power. Well, Innocent III did pull off, his successors did not pull off. And by the way, one of the reasons was, listen to me, that the seeds of it, that Innocent III's program of asserting these claims outlined by Gregory VII had in it, as I've already suggested, the seeds of its own destruction. Now listen to me, why could Innocent III caused trouble for Frederick and Otto in their own backyard? Why could they really cause John trouble? Because and why could he force Philip to take back his wife in France? Because they could threaten people at the local level. It was a spiritual threat. We'll keep you out of heaven. We'll make sure you stay in purgatory a long time. Spiritual threat. But you see, when the church so openly became a political force, we're going to see from now on the popes threaten this time and time again with decreasing influence. The time was, Innocent III, he could threaten Europe with interdiction, with anathema, with excommunication, and shake up society. But you see, it's like calling wolf. Or it's like threatening somebody too many times. From now on, every time the popes do this, it has less and less effect. Even his successors, they couldn't pull off what Innocent III. You see what I'm saying? Had the seeds of his own destruction. It's like it's the principle of diminishing returns. Until finally, we get to our next section, the Protestant Reformation, when he threatens John. And he threatens Henry, and Henry just refuses to be threatened. The Pope, for instance, commands Frederick the Wise to turn over Martin Luther, and Frederick the Wise simply says no. How can he say no to the Pope? You get what I'm saying? Every generation became increasingly easy to say, forget it. And so historians agree that from this time, the papacy claims more and more authority, but it actually enjoys less and less. And the more it claims, the less it actually has. Until today, by the way, do you realize that officially, the Roman Catholic Church claims to be the primary authority in the whole world? Do you know that? That's their official dogma. They claim to be the number one authority in the whole world. That's why, for instance, they still play games at it. The Pope always manages to get his finger in the pie whenever there's, for instance, remember how the Pope in the Iranian hostage situation, he tried to come in and arbitrate. Nobody paid any attention to him. Okay. Why? Why would he try to do that? You must understand that the claims have never diminished legally. When, yes. Yes.
Americans wouldn't put up with that kind of business. By the way, when John F. Kennedy, you know, the first Catholic president, was elected, if you can remember, I remember this, many churchmen pointed out that there was a legitimate question to raise whether Kennedy, his first allegiance would be to the Constitution of the United States or to the Roman Papacy. And when that question was raised, the Roman Catholic Church unleashed a propaganda blitz. Their catchword was the word bigotry. Man, that word flew. You had to wade through it. Every time anybody said anything about it, the word bigotry was waved like a flag. And the Roman Catholic Church, remember, the cardinal of Baltimore simply said that there's nothing in Roman Catholicism that would influence in any way Kennedy to have a first allegiance to the Pope and a second allegiance to the Constitution. And they announced this just before the election, and it was an absolute lie. In other words, that was published officially published by the cardinal of Baltimore. Roman Catholic cardinal in the United States, and it's absolutely false. And a few stalwart souls went on record pointing out the documentation, saying that is false, and they again were just flat. They were just blown away by the charge of bigotry. But bigotry or not, they can say, well, we don't claim this. They do claim that. That's the official dogma of the Roman Catholic Church. Remember I said that they said that the Roman Catholic Church will tell you if you ask them that they have never, no pope has ever enjoyed all the authority which is legally his? That's true. Well, anyway, you see what's happening now? The France becomes the leading power. When Innocent III broke the power of the Holy Roman Empire, France was left alone. By the way, Innocent III is in dividing and conquering Germany, really, that also contained in it the seeds of destruction of papal power. France was the most powerful. I've already talked about its loss of its moral prestige, number two. Number three, modern states begin to emerge with a king who enjoy centralized control. We're looking toward the Renaissance now. Philip the Fair of France was the first of these kings who simply said that if I'm going to be king of France, I've got to have absolute authority in France, not the Pope. And so we come to the humiliation of the papacy in the hands of Philip the Fair, 1268 to 1314. We're going to talk about a reversal, whereas we see Innocent III causing Philip II to take back a wife. Now we've got the king of France, Philip the Fair, he's called, who needed money to fight his war, so he proceeded to simply tax church property, which was by the way, since the church owned so much of France, there's no way he was going to raise money without taxing their property, and so he simply did it. Well, Boniface VIII, who was the pope now, he issued the famous bull Clericus Laicus, in which he denounced the attempt to tax these lands. You know, that money was supposed to come to Rome. Philip responded, he simply blockaded the money from passing over the Alps. He said, the money can't leave town, or can't leave France. Well, Boniface had to give in because he didn't have any choice. He said, okay, if you're going to do it, you're going to do it. And so he had to give in, whereas before it had been the king of France that gave in to Innocent III, now the other way around. Well, that wasn't enough for Philip. A papal envoy came, and whereas we saw King John of England bowing before the papal legate, when the papal legate showed up in the court of Philip the Fair, he just arrested him, put him on trial for treason. He was a Frenchman. Tell me, if your first loyalty is to France, and so you're a traitor. But it was really a gesture, what it was. He was openly challenging the authority of Rome. Well, Boniface VIII issued the famous Unum Sanctum. By the way, this is a primary document in the Roman Catholic Church. This is ex cathedra. This is official dogma. If you ever want to know what your Roman Catholic Church claims, look at Unum Sanctum. See, it's being challenged now. By the way, this has never been revoked. This is official dogma, an official bull. Let's read it. We are obliged. This is Boniface VIII responding to this open challenge to his authority by Philip. We are obliged by the faith to believe and hold that there is one Catholic and Apostolic Church, and outside this church there is neither salvation nor remission of sins. Roman Catholic Church likes to say, oh, we never teach we're the only church. That's a lie. That's absolutely false. They do teach that. One of this one and only church, there is one body, not two heads like a monster, namely Christ, and that is one head, that is not two heads. He meant the king and the pope. Namely Christ, that is Christ is the one head, and Christ's vicar is Peter, and Peter's successor, for the Lord said to Peter himself, feed my sheep, and we learn from the words of the gospel that in this church and in her power are two swords, the spiritual and the temporal. Truly, he who denies that the temporal sword is in the power of Peter misunderstands the words of the Lord. But the latter, temporal, is to be used for the church, the former spiritual by the church. The former by the priests, the latter by the kings and captains, but at the will and by the permission of the priest. So who's in charge? The church is in charge. The one sword, then, should be under the other, the temporal and temporal authority subject to spiritual. There it is. By the way, see, this is one of the things that when the Kennedy election raised that issue, this is one of the documents that they would simply point out. What does the church actually teach? Furthermore, we declare, state, define, and pronounce that it is altogether necessary to salvation for every human creature to be subject to the Roman pontiff. Well, let there be no doubt. That is what the church teaches. That is the official position, and it still is. Like it's been increased, yes. Pontiff means pope. That's another title for the papacy. The pontiff was an old Roman, really it means keeper of the bridge, literally. Pontus is the Latin word for bridge. It was an old pagan Roman high office, but without going into its history, it was a religious office. The pontiff was the man in charge of religion in pagan Rome, the bureaucratic head of religion, and therefore in the Roman papacy appropriated that title for itself. But it's an old Roman pagan title that's been baptized. Okay? Good question. Well, what was Philip's response to the Unum Sanctum? Well, he called, and this is for the first time, by the way, this is the first expression of what you would call republican government since the classical ages. Philip called together the Estates General, it was called, who were representatives of all the ruling elements in France. He simply got together the leaders of the country, and he asked them what he should do. He asked their advice. Very smart thing to do. He got almost universal support, including the leaders of the church in France, to defy the Pope, and so he did. In fact, he sent one of his men to Italy to bring the Pope back to France for trial. Now, think about this. The Pope... What the Pope was doing was illegal, according to what the Estates General decided, so he simply sent his men to arrest the Pope. Now, can you imagine that? That's not to make Innocent III spin in his grave. You know, go arrest that fellow, that Italian, who's trying to cause so much trouble. And lo and behold, this fellow sneaked into Italy, and nobody would ever suspect a thing would happen, and he kidnapped the Pope and started to France with him. Sneaked him out of the papal palace in the middle of the night and headed for France. Well, he got as far as the Nangi in northern Italy, up in here, and he almost made it. Can you imagine this, kidnapping the Pope? He almost made it out of the country. Some of the Pope's friends heard about it and got on his trail and got up a posse and rescued Boniface. However, he was an old man, Boniface was, and he was so upset by what had happened that he died very quickly after that. I mean, he actually died of just, somebody said, in the old times, he busted the blood vessel. He was so mad that, you know, the idea of kidnapping Peter, or Peter's successor, you know, I mean, that's like attacking God. That's how he thought of himself. And he couldn't more than he could take, and he died of it, of this consternation. Well, Clement V, who was the successor to Boniface VIII, he was helpless when Philip moved against the Knights Templar. This was an order of the church in France. By the way, what Philip did, the Knights Templar were very wealthy, and Philip needed money to fight his wars, mainly with England. So what did he do? He trumped up, y'all with me now? Remember the Knights Templar? It was an order that came into being during the Crusades. So they're a very wealthy private club or lodge kind of thing in France. And in order to get their money and to break their power, Philip trumped up charges against de Molay, who was the leader of the Knights Templar, this Catholic order in France, trumped up charges and had him executed. And de Molay, therefore, has become a hero of the Roman Catholic Church. By the way, where have you heard the word de Molay before? What is it? It is the junior league of the Masonic Lodge. It is the Masonic Lodge. It is the Masonic Lodge runs de Molay for young boys, young men, teenagers. I don't know how what age you have to be. And when you get too old for de Molay, you go into the Masonic Lodge.